This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. This week, the Granite State was again filled with Republican presidential contenders hoping to distinguish themselves from a crowded field. For example, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul used the debate in Congress over the Patriot Act to make a pointed comparison with a particular Republican opponent.
We have one candidate, we won't mention any name, but who's a former governor of Florida, who says that the best thing the president is doing is collecting all of your phone records without a warrant.
Elsewhere, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum made a rare visit to New Hampshire, where he spoke about family, his conservative values, and his populist economic message.
We need to provide opportunities for everybody, not just those who have wealth and opportunity. We need to make sure that the 74% of Americans who don't have a college degree have an opportunity to pursue the American dream.
And for those hoping to escape the political news by taking to the woods, Alan Eaton, a UNH entomologist, has a few words of wisdom for you. Keep an eye out for ticks.
There's too many people that don't think about this, don't check for ticks during this period of time. And we are in the state that has the second highest incidence of Lyme disease in the entire country.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the Roundup this week are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Trent Spinner, executive editor at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Trent, good to see you too. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is Allie Moore. She's a reporter for the Concord Monitor. She's been covering energy issues a lot lately. And Allie, thank you for taking time out.
Sure, thanks.
Well, and Allie, I want to start with you with the Renewable Energy Fund. The House budget took away the $50 million from this dedicated fund in its goal of helping to balance the overall budget. The Senate then this week, Allie, put the money back. How come?
Yeah, so the Renewable Energy Fund, it pays out rebates to people and businesses who want to install solar, wind, biomass, renewable technology, meant to promote those kinds of technologies. And so I think while not everybody agrees with the purpose of the fund, sort of subsidizing this development, Republican senators have been pretty clear that they don't want to raise dedicated funds to balance the budget. And so this was an instance where they basically wiped out the fund for the next 2 years, the House budget did. And so senators were pretty quick to put that money back and say, you know, we don't want to balance the budget this way. We want a responsible budget without using these dedicated funds.
So they voted to return the money. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much that they, you know, are all in love with solar and wind and bio, but they felt that integrity in the budgeting process dictated that they not raid these dedicated funds.
Exactly. So instead of spending the money on solar rebates, they didn't want to put it to roads and bridges, for example.
So how will the Senate, Allie, deal with the $50 million that's now missing?
Yeah, so I think that's really the question. I think of note is that the House budget estimated that that fund would have $50 million in it over the next 2 years, and recent estimates show that it would really be half that money. So there's really only $25 million there for the taking. So either way, the Senate would have had to make up some of that money. And I think that's really the question. I think we'll get a better sense in the coming weeks once the Senate finalizes their revenue estimates. I think a lot of people think that they'll have some higher numbers than what the House had, and that will give them some more wiggle room. But they'll be coming up to some of those hard decisions in the next few weeks about where to find that $50 million.
Sure. And Allie, hold on a minute. I just want to bring our studio guests into this, too. Dean Spiliotis, were you surprised by this decision by the state Senate?
Maybe a little bit, but not tremendously so. As Allie mentioned, I think this really was a case of Republican senators being quite public about the idea that you shouldn't be raiding dedicated funds to build a budget. So it's kind of a budgetary principle rather than a statement about the policy. I can cite examples where both in the state and nationally in Congress, Republicans have actually opposed subsidizing wind and solar, sort of ambivalence about energy conservation incentives, those kinds of programs. So I don't think this was so much about, a burning desire for them to restore these programs. It's a bigger statement about the principle of not raiding dedicated funds. There may be, down the line, there may be other programs that are very important to them that they would not want raided either. So they've said up front, I think, for a long time that this is not the way they were going to proceed. And so far, they've stuck to their word.
Well, and Allie, I want to ask you about another energy story that you've been tracking. That's Northern Pass, the big hydropower project proposal. New Hampshire's congressional delegation this week renewed its call to extend the public comment period for a federal study of Northern Pass. Couple questions for you, Allie, here, please. What does the federal government need to study?
Sure. So this project, Northern Pass wants to run 187 mile transmission line through New Hampshire. And in order to do that, they need both federal and state approval to move forward. And so, one of the steps in that federal process is this environmental impact statement that is what we're talking about now, that would sort of look at the environmental effects of the proposed route. But it looks at more than two dozen other options that the feds have identified as potential alternatives to what Northern Pass is proposing. So it's quite a lot of work. They're looking at a lot of different environmental impacts of this transmission line. And so the feds will be studying the environmental impacts of all of that. And in the draft, I think they'll make some recommendations about how the line can have the least impact. And so, as my understanding is, Northern Pass will then take some of those recommendations in that draft environmental study and potentially alter the route before they start the state process. So this review is a pretty big deal, and it's expected to come out this summer.
Wow, two dozen alternatives. I didn't realize, Allie, there were that many other options on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they released a list of them about a year ago in May.
And Trent, to you, please, why do you think the delegation felt 60 days wasn't enough? Why do you think they're getting involved in this?
I think that the delegation, some members of the delegation think that some of these lines should be buried, and they want that to come out. And the other thing I think is that everywhere they go, especially in the North Country, they're hearing from people who say, hey, we need more time to look at this, to talk about this. And so that's why they were united on this.
Does it reach a point, Trent, where they have to say, yes, I like this option, no, I don't? Or can they just continue to say, more study, more time, and so forth?
Senator Ayotte has come out and said, hey, we need to bury the lines in some places here. So, yes, there is absolutely going to be a point where they need to look at the plan and say yes or no.
What are the politics of this, Dean?
Yeah, it's interesting. These bureaucratic agencies have kind of a regular cycle, whether it's a rulemaking or a release of a study or just the kind of the process by which you get approval for these sorts of projects. And, the delegation is asking for this, 90 days to hearings after the report and then another 90 days for comment. That's a little bit unusual. Typically, the period is about 45 days, maybe 60 days as the case here. So it's not clear to me. I mean, they've already denied the request once. This would be out of the norm for your typical kind of rulemaking process, which is, I think, why, the bureaucracy is sort of sticking to their guns at the moment.
All right. Allie, this is a story we haven't talked about in a while, so it's good to get the update from you. Last question, please. What happens next?
Yeah, definitely. So once the draft EIS comes out, I think it's expected to be in the realm of about 2,000 pages. So I'm sure people will be poring over that. Once that comes out, I think we're hearing that Northern Pass is going to kind of take that under review and potentially come out with some compromise solution on the line. I think a lot of people expect there might be some more burial in sensitive areas, maybe the White Mountain National Forest. And then the company will likely start the state permitting process, which goes through a board here that's made up of state officials, energy regulators, and now a few new public members. So I'm sure eyes will turn to the state process once that federal draft comes out.
And within that state process, too, Allie, correct me if I'm wrong, please, there are town approvals or at least weighing in on the issue, right, regarding the towns that this might go through?
yeah, it goes through over 30 towns, and I'm sure most of them want to have a say in the project.
All right. Allie, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Allie Morris, reporter with the Concord Monitor. She's been covering some energy issues lately. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Join us as we cover some of the top headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gentlemen, real quick, there was a big story out of the State House yesterday. The state Senate dean tabled a measure to repeal the state buffer zone law around abortion clinics. I feel like we've been talking about this for a couple years now, but just remind us what this is all about, please.
Yes, we have. You know, this was a rule that was passed to have, I believe, a 25-foot buffer around abortion clinics. The idea is it's supposed to make it a safer environment for individuals who need the services of the clinics, while at the same time still protecting the First Amendment rights of protesters. And the protesters claim that no, it's not fair. There was a larger buffer zone in Massachusetts that was declared unconstitutional. Constitutional, you know, the one we have here was supposedly kind of written in a way that would probably stand constitutional muster, but we don't know that for sure. So we're waiting to see. You know, it's basically tabled because there's really no sense on kind of making a decision about this until we see what the kind of the full legal ramifications are of this smaller buffer.
And this got caught up with Massachusetts somehow, right? Trent, fill us in.
Right. So New Hampshire and Massachusetts both passed similar laws, and it depends who you ask about how similar those laws were. Democrats will say they weren't that similar and that New Hampshire's law was tailored around Massachusetts law so that this would stand a Supreme Court challenge. Republicans say, no, this is pretty similar. This is so similar that we would be wasting the state's money because we'd have to fight this all the way to D.C. So House Republicans said the House voted to repeal this law. And then what happened was the Senate deadlocked 12-12 with two Republican senators voting with Democrats. Senator Stiles and Jerry Little from Ware, and they agreed that this law was similar.
So basically, why move forward? Because we don't know what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do about Massachusetts law.
Well, we do know. We do know. The question was, what would the Supreme Court do about New Hampshire law?
I see. Okay. All right. Well, gentlemen, coming up, we turn to politics. And boy, there is a lot to talk about this week, including two Republican presidential candidates who say they will not spend much time in the Granite State. We'll find out who they are. We'll also find out who visited this week. There were a lot of people who were very happy to spend time in New Hampshire. And we'll follow up on a big story that came out this week. A New Hampshire congressman runs into trouble with the Federal Election Commission. All that coming up. Stay with us for more of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, and we turn now to politics. In addition to some entrants to the presidential race here in the Granite State, a New Hampshire congressman has had some campaign finance woes. We're going to talk about those stories and more this hour. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Trent Spinner is here. He's with the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And with us now is Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. And Josh, lots of politics to cover this week. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the big story, and that's Frank Ginta, the first district congressman, was the subject of a Federal Election Commission investigation, which came to some conclusions this week. This is a confusing story, Josh, so I'd like to unravel it piece by piece, please. First of all, just which race is this about? Because Frank Ginta's run several times.
Well, this stems from donations that were, loans that Congressman Ginta, loans that were made to his campaign. He said they were made by him. The FEC found that there were 9 checks that he took from his mother, 1 from his father, totaling $381,000 in 2009 and 2010. So this would have been his first race for Congress. The issue was first brought up during the primary. Republicans were questioning the source of this money. Congressman Gint has had various answers to this, that this was money he earned, that this money came from investments, that this money came from consulting, that this money came from real estate and from savings. The FEC, you know, at long last has found that these checks were written and came from his parents. Congressman Gint says that this was money that this was a family account in which he held what he described as an equitable interest, which is a term common in trust and custodial law. The FEC didn't seem to buy that. The documents from the FEC investigation have not been released, so we don't really know exactly what sort of case Congressman Ginta made to the FEC. But the case he had made to reporters here and to the public was that he didn't get this money from his parents. He said that repeatedly, and this was an issue in every congressional race he's run in when he won the first time, lost the second time, won the third time. And in this last race, he was particularly vehement in attacking Carol Shea Porter when she brought up this issue, saying that she was lying about his record and that suggesting in the final debate on WMUR that he had been cleared, whether or not, you know, he may have misspoken. That's what he says. He was talking about a House Ethics Committee looking at his record. In any case, he's on the record saying repeatedly that this money didn't come from his parents. The FEC found otherwise.
So a crowded primary, Republican primary for the 1st Congressional District in 2010.
The closed primary.
2,000 votes.
Yeah.
About 2,000 votes.
Wow. So Frank Ginta gets this money and questions are raised about it, including by our own John Greenberg here at NPR. He dug into this a lot.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the questions were out there. I mean, this came from Republicans during the primary. Certainly Democrats were happy to leap on board. But again, Congressman Ginta through the years has had sort of a ambulatory sort of answers to this, ultimately saying, no, this money didn't come from my parents. You know, the FEC says otherwise.
Well, like they used to say in D.C., it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. I mean, what's been the fallout for this then? Not so much the fact that it was, you know, this campaign finance issue, but the fact that he has, well, sort of dodged answering this question directly.
Well,
what's been the fallout?
Well,
from this?
I mean, we'll see. I mean, certainly, you know, people who are his political opponents and people who haven't bought those answers have always been critical. But I mean, so far, you know, he's in Congress. He's done all right. We'll see what this means going forward. And the implications for all Republicans, and you look at, you know, Jeb Bush held a fundraiser for him. Senator Ayotte has held fundraisers for him. He's been ordered to pay this money back. And, you know, precisely where this money would go back, presumably to the accounts on which the checks were originally drawn. So, you know, he's in a position of having a year to have to drum up $355,000 from his campaign account to pay back to his parents. That may not be the most compelling fundraising pitch. And so we'll see moving forward. And obviously he's facing tough criticism, you know, this morning. I mean, certainly I'm assuming we're going to talk about Joe McQuaid's editorial in the Union Leader, very, very pointed.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Trent. And again, you didn't write it. Joe McQuaid, the publisher, wrote it. But for those who haven't seen the Union Leader editorial, what's the UL's take on how Frank Ginta has handled this?
Well, the publisher, Joe McQuaid, thinks that Frank Ginta is lying about this. And if you read the editorial, it's pretty clear. Not Joe doesn't need 140 characters to spell it out. So, look, we talked to Frank Ginta and we asked him very pointed questions. And we ran the story yesterday about where did this money come from? Where is this money going back to? How is this possible? And he says he has an equitable interest. He says that he has documents to prove it. He says that they're compiling that information and that they're going to bring that to us and show us those documents to prove this equitable interest. Here's the thing. We talked to bankers. We talked to lawyers. We talked to people who set up trusts. And they say, after reading your story, they say, look, I'm not specifically commenting about Congressman Ginta, but after reading your story and seeing what he says in there, there's no financial instrument that works the way he is describing it. So,
what's an equitable interest?
Exactly.
No, what
no,
is
exactly.
That?
No, exactly. Nobody is very clear. No, that's the thing.
I see.
Is that when you talk to people – an equitable interest is something that is some sort of what they're saying is that, look, if you have a bank account with your parents, just putting money into it doesn't give you an interest, doesn't give you a right to pull that money out. If you have a bank account number, you can deposit money into anyone's account, these bankers told us. But that doesn't mean that you have a right to take the money out. And he disclosed this. He after his amended forms, he ended up saying that this was his bank account. But if it's his bank account, why didn't he just write the check himself to his campaign? And that's what the FEC found, was that his parents actually wrote him a check. And then the next day or within a very short amount of time, those checks ended up – that amount of money ended up in his campaign fund.
Well, and Dean, here's my question for you. It's a little bit different. So less than $400,000, as Josh Rogers told us, in an era of mega super PACs spending mega super amounts of money, you know, in favor of certain candidates, even though they're not officially associated, how much does an FEC violation of less than $400K move the needle on this larger discussion of money in politics?
Yeah, I don't see this as primarily an issue of, you know, the amount of money in politics and the grand scheme of the kinds of millions of dollars and tens of millions of dollars that are now being spent even on congressional races. It's a fairly small amount. And I think, you know, I don't think you're going to see this resonating into that discussion. Or, you know, maybe some people will say, well, he felt pressured because of how expensive it is to run for Congress to come up with this money to be competitive. But, you know, the bigger issue is, you know, Republican challengers and Democratic opponents are going to kind of go at his candor on this. And I think, you know, I'm no tax lawyer or financial analyst, but, you know, the easiest way to, if what he's saying is true, then at some point he should be able to prove that he put in excess of that amount of money into the account. And then it simply becomes a legal issue of whether or not you can draw if the account's not in your name, which is, you know, his parents wrote these checks. But he says at least over $355,000 of that is his own money. So I assume at some point either, you know, dividend checks or salary checks or whatever, something to prove that he actually had this kind of money in that account. That would, in some sense, I think, settle it. But it's just been – it's something that's been a problem for him, and I don't see it going away. It's getting national coverage. The video footage of him talking to Carol Shea Porter is going viral, so he's going to have to try to clarify this at some point.
Wow. Okay. Well, Josh, let's wrap up this story and then turn to a couple other political stories. Go ahead. Final thoughts on this Ginter story.
We'll see where this goes. And certainly, you know, Joe McQuaid's editorial, Franken is a damned liar, you know, it's also kind of a, you know, it's almost someone in a bar room saying, you know, you want to contest that, you know, you're going to be dealing with me as well. And how other Republicans, I mean, thus far, people have been publicly quite quiet about this. I mean, you know, Kelly Ayotte has events today. She's obviously going to have to comment on this. It's going to be interesting to see what she says as essentially the leader of the party in the state and whether rank and file Republicans, what they say. And it's going to be interesting to see what sort of documentation Congressman Ginta gave to the FEC. And, you know, not many cases get through the FEC due to the you know, what's been accurately described as gridlock. And so this, you know, it's bipartisan body. You know, some Republicans had to believe that there was there. And, you know, Congressman Ginta has given himself very little room, given how adamant and vehement he's been that there was nothing to this.
Trent, go ahead.
I guess I would disagree about the size of this problem. I think this is a massive problem for Frank Ginta. I think that this is this has the potential to really unfold. Here's the other thing. In that election, that 2010 election, $400,000 made a huge difference. I mean, he won by 2,000 votes. So it's very easy for some of the other people who ran in that primary who are still politically active to say, hey, wait a second, that election was stolen from me.
And we don't know what representations Congressman Ginta made privately. I mean, some of these people, you know, Rich Ashew and Sean Mahoney, the two closest competitors in that primary, they got on board and chaired his campaign in the general election, you know, as a gesture of goodwill. You know, we don't know what Frank Ginta has said to Republicans who may have asked him, what's up with this money? If he said, oh, no, everything's fine, don't worry about it. You know, if he's on the ticket the next time, you can guarantee that the Democrats are going to work, you know, as hard as they have, you know, with limited success thus far to really hang this on the entire party. But, you know, now there's going to be something to work with. So, you know, Franken has yet to have any public events. He did talk to the union leader, but it's really going to be interesting to watch this one.
All right. Well, and Trent, we'll keep an eye on some of those conversations that you had with Congressman Ginta and some of the reporting that comes out of that. I want to remind everybody that it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions, comments, thoughts as we talk about some of the top news stories of the week. And Josh Rogers, there's actually some breaking news this morning about a court decision concerning voter laws here in New Hampshire. What's going on?
Well, the Supreme Court has ruled in the case, I think it's the title is Guare versus State of New Hampshire, which was, you know, over language in voter registration forms that said it essentially, you know, it was an expectation that people who register to vote here have to comply with other laws, including motor vehicle laws. This language was added, I think, in post-2010 when Republicans took control of both bodies. Governor Lynch vetoed it. It was overridden. This was challenged by the ACLU and several students, League of Women Voters. The lower court said the language was unconstitutional. It was appealed. The state's highest court has agreed with the lower court ruling. It said that the state has failed to establish that the challenge language is necessary to comply with the Help America Vote Act, and it's failed to demonstrate that the challenge language addresses compliance with that, and also that basically the challenge language unreasonably burdens the fundamental right to vote, and therefore they've affirmed the lower court ruling that it violates Part 1, Article 2 of the Constitution. So this is a case that a lot of people were waiting for, and the ruling was unanimous.
Right. Wow. A unanimous ruling. Well, and important, right, guys, because the New Hampshire presidential primary coming up. So there'll be a lot of people who will be excited about voting. And Dean Spiliotis, just remind us who was here this week. It was a busy week.
Yeah, it has been a busy week. We had at least 8 contenders in the state. On the Republican side, Ben Carson, the pediatric surgeon, Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, Chris Christie, Donald Trump, Lindsey Graham. And then on the Democratic side, Martin O'Malley was here during the week, and Jim Webb, former senator from Virginia, originally a Republican, now a Democrat, is making his first appearance in the state today. So it's very busy. Been a couple of polls out in recent weeks that show 4 or 5 candidates all clustered in the teens, Jeb Bush, Rand Paul, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, and maybe Ted Cruz in some of the polls as well. So it's quite an active primary on the Republican side for sure.
Yeah, Trent, how would you describe the dynamic of this Republican race right now? What sort of observations would you make about it?
I think it's awesome. I think this is an incredible primary, a historic primary, and it's a lot of fun to cover. I think what people are trying to do is really lock up supporters, and it's still early, but Ted Cruz was able to do that this week. I think that was big for him. And I think that's what people are trying to do. They're, on the one hand, they're trying to introduce themselves to voters, but what they're really trying to do is introduce themselves to people who influence the party.
Grassroots activists, those coveted endorsements
exactly.
From people, big figures who can hopefully reach out to other figures.
Or small figures.
Or small figures. Ted Cruz did announce his list of endorsements. Like you said, Trent, what kind of political activists, Josh, are backing Team Cruz?
Well, I mean, staunch conservatives. And for somebody who has been running as I'm the true conservative, having Bob Smith, Executive Counselor David Wheeler, and former House Speaker Bill O'Brien on your side, suggests that hardcore conservatives believe you. So that should be helpful.
Yeah, that's not too shabby a list then. For Senator Cruz.
No. And it remains to be seen how much time Senator Cruz is going to spend here. And a lot of, Rick Santorum, you could ask the same question of him, whether or not New Hampshire is necessarily the most fertile ground for him. He was here. But, there are primaries within primaries. And, there are so many Republicans running that a lot of them on the right are going to be, there's going to be a winnowing at some point. And, the absence of a front runner is really pronounced. I mean, you look at some of the missteps that Jeb Bush had this week on the subject of Iraq. And, I've talked to some Republicans here who were a little sort of restive by some of those comments.
He
was asked a question about, would you go to Iraq knowing what we know now? And, there's some debate about whether he properly understood the question. But, he initially said, yes, I would. Then he ultimately, as the week went on, there were several answers. And now the question is, no, I wouldn't.
And he also said that his brother, the former President George W. Bush, would be a close foreign policy advisor of his. Now, we know he left office with very low approval rating, a lot of unhappiness over the war in Iraq. And so some Republicans were questioning whether or not that was sort of the, he's trying to, Jeb Bush is trying to sort of define himself as his own person. And then to go and say that your very unpopular former president brother is going to be a close foreign policy advisor made some Republican activists a little uncomfortable.
Well, speaking of Ted Cruz drawing all the social conservatives, if that's the case, Trent Spinner, who's left for Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee? They're also social conservatives.
They are. And they have to do very well in Iowa if they want to compete. And maybe they don't even play in New Hampshire. They say, we're going to try to win Iowa. We're going to skip right to South Carolina.
Didn't they say something this week to that effect, Dean?
Yeah, certainly Rick Santorum certainly said if he runs, he's not going to spend as much time in New Hampshire. You know, we've talked about this before, the Iowa caucus for Republicans dominated by evangelicals. About 60 or 65% of the caucus goers are evangelical. South Carolina, lots of social and religious conservatives. You know, we're going to talk later about the Pew study that just came out that New Hampshire continues to be the second least religious state behind Vermont in the country. So, I certainly saw it with Mike Huckabee and also with Rick Santorum to some extent. They get this tremendous energy and momentum in Iowa in the kind of social and religious conservative vein. And then they come here and they have to kind of shift to talking about libertarianism and foreign policy. And particularly Huckabee, I saw it just kind of totally deflate him. You know, Rick Santorum hung in there last time and ended up, I think, having the second most number of delegates behind Mitt Romney. But
now
it wasn't all that
economic
close.
Populist
yeah, exactly. Message. Yeah. But it's just the juxtaposition of Iowa and New Hampshire is consistently problematic for social and religious conservatives who do well in Iowa. So I don't expect to see either Huckabee or Santorum here a lot.
Yeah, Trent, to you, and then I have another question for you, Josh.
And Dean brings up a great point about 60% of Iowa caucus goers say that they describe themselves as evangelical Christians. So let's say Ted Cruz goes in there, says, I'm that candidate, vote for me. He wins Iowa. He raises, let's say, $10 million in the 7 days between Iowa and New Hampshire, comes to New Hampshire. He doesn't need to win New Hampshire to win New Hampshire, and then leaves here maybe second place or a strong third, goes to South Carolina, and now the ball's rolling.
It's possible. I would be hard-pressed at the moment to see him coming in second in New Hampshire, but, you know, we'll see.
Well, speaking of endorsements, Rand Paul also, Josh Rogers, released a long list of supporters. What kind of people are on that list?
Well, lots of House members, sort of, liberty Republicans, a lot of them. And, you know, Rand Paul has spent a lot of time here. He has, if the New Hampshire primary were held today, I think, he would be right in the mix. And, he's obviously has a message that, encapsulates some of what his father stood for, but he's been broadening that and he's been spending a lot of time here. He has people who know how to run campaigns here. And, he's definitely, at the risk of, sort of establishing tiers of candidates. I mean, he's certainly, he's among the front runners.
All right. Well, Josh, I know you have to go. Thank you very much for giving us your time. We really appreciate
You're welcome, Laura.
That's Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Coming up on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, we're going to turn to some other topics in the news this week, including warnings about the ticks this spring and summer. We'll also look at the retirement of Manchester's police chief, some concerns about avian flu, and that study that you mentioned a minute ago, Dean Spiliotis, Religious Preferences in America. I've got some Facebook comments and some emails as well that I'll share with you. So all that's coming up on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week. We've been looking at presidential politics, also an emerging story about Congressman Frank Ginta and the Federal Election Commission. In just a moment, we'll cover a story concerning avian flu and also look at the tick predictions for this spring and summer. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And folks, here's an email that came in from Gus in Durham. He says, the only stated reason I've ever heard for why we need to constrain political participation by limiting campaign contributions is to prevent undue influence over government actions. Perhaps Frank Ginta took too much money from his parents. Gus asks, but why is that such a huge thing? What are we afraid of? Are we really concerned that his parents now have too much influence over him because they gave him money? Perhaps it's the rule that is a problem, not how well or badly it was followed. Gus, thank you for the email. And, Dean, this gets to a question that I asked you before the break. You know, in an era when there's mega money out there, less than $400K isn't that much?
Certainly, in terms of the overall debate about the amount of money in politics, I think the bigger issue for Mr. Ginta is, the explanations or lack thereof that we've had over the last 5 years. I think Trent made a great point about the fact that this was a very close race and that money may have made a difference in that particular race. I think that's, sort of one way in which you could make the case that, it was an unfair advantage. But in terms of the larger, debate about campaign finance, when you have, billionaires spending $10, $20, $50 million in election cycles, not a big amount.
Well, and on Facebook, Greg agrees with Gus, our emailer. Greg says, so much outrage over a guy borrowing a few bucks from mom. But then Chris on Facebook says the mismanagement of funds is bad, but his continued lying until he was caught is far worse. I think that's some of the point that your paper has been looking at, Trent.
Yes, and the other thing to keep in mind is that this $15,000 fine might be the largest the FEC hands out this year.
All right. Well, thank you for the Facebook comments. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call to 1-800-892-6477. And guys, I want to go to our colleague David Brooks now at the Telegraph of Nashua. Two stories that caught our eye this week. And Dave Brooks, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the first story is kind of icky, Dave. Ticks. What's the forecast for the ticks this spring and summer?
No, that's not icky. That's part of nature. we've gotten used to this now. It's been about a decade since Lyme disease has been around and ticks has been here. Today, I believe, actually, the governor is supposed to sign a bill that was first put forward by a Nashua rep, Pamela Brown, making May Lyme Disease Awareness Month. Because really the big thing about Lyme disease and ticks is awareness and is public education. The disease is continuing to spread. It's obviously a big deal up here. For a couple of years, we've had the highest per capita rate of reported Lyme disease in the country, really. Lyme disease is not an automatically reportable disease, so the numbers are a little squishy, but still there's a lot of it around. Many people thought that the brutal winter would kill off the ticks, but it's actually the exact opposite. With all that snow on the ground, the ticks were nice and comfortable and protected from the cold. So they have come out, and there's been a lot of them. I know veterinarians, certainly, that tends to be where people spot ticks the first, and the ticks have been all over animals for a while.
Wow, so, and the dogs and cats. Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Dogs and cats and you. And so the advice is the same as it's been for a while, is the best thing to do is to keep from getting bitten. You know, don't stay inside because it's too beautiful to stay inside, but if you go outside, I have a pair of long, very light pants, so they're not too hot, and they have permethrin in them, so the ticks die if they grab onto them. And I tuck them into my socks, which is the new cool look. I mean, I think the hipsters in Brooklyn will be picking it up soon.
What are those pants, Dave? What's the substance you said your pants are treated with?
Permethrin, which is it kills ticks. You can spray it around. You can put it on your yard, but it's, you know, you don't like spraying chemicals around if you can avoid it. So it's actually in the fabric itself. So if the ticks grab on, what ticks don't jump on you, they grab on as you walk past. If they grab onto my pants, they'll get the insecticide and they'll die.
Great. I'm going to borrow those pants from you at some point, Dave. You know,
they're a little long for you.
Yeah. Well, and what about the proliferation of deer in southern New Hampshire? I mean, how does that play into this tick/Lyme disease concern?
So there's a complicated – so it's actually a microbe that the ticks carry is what causes the disease. And when they bite us, they pass the – and they feed on our blood, they pass the microbe into our bloodstream. They get the microbe from – usually they actually get it from mice. It's a complicated life cycle, but it's both deer and actually the black-footed mouse, which has become very, very prevalent in the area. Those are the two things that form sort of reservoirs, and the ticks pick up the microbe from them and pass it on to us. So deer is part of the problem, but probably a bigger problem is the mice, which is a function of actually landscaping. And Nashua put out a toolkit for people as to how to avoid Lyme disease, and part of it is how to landscape your property so that mice are less likely to come out of the woods on the edge of your property and into your yard. And when they come out of the woods on your yard, that's when they drop the ticks, and then you walk past and the tick jumps on you. So there are some surprisingly subtle things you can do to reduce your risk.
All right, and I think later this month we're going to do a whole show on that, so I'll set that aside for the moment. But Dave, you also covered an avian flu story this week, reporting that 30 million chickens have been killed by this elsewhere. Where's this coming from?
Yeah, it's a disease. It's two strains of the same disease that first cropped up in Asia and has shown up over here. It started pretty much this year. It's incredibly virulent, kills birds, and is passed between them very readily. It does not get passed to any other animals. Doesn't get passed to humans. But between birds, it's really bad. There's actually two strains of it called H5N8 and H5N2, which sort of refer to the proteins that are involved. It started in the West Coast, and it was spread up and down the West Coast by wild birds. And this is part of the issue, is that wild birds can bring it into your flock.
I see.
And down the what they call the Pacific Flyway. Then it spread to the Mississippi River Flyway up and down the Mississippi. And that's where the big problem is, because that's where most of our huge industrial poultry farms are. So the state of Iowa has killed 24 million chickens. And one of the problems they're having is it's very hard to dispose of that many bodies at once because there are these massive farms. A single barn will have more chickens than exist in all of New Hampshire. And once the disease gets in, they all have to be killed.
Wow. So this is spread by wild birds, from a particular chicken farm. The wild bird gets infected, and then it goes its merry way and infects the next chicken farm.
That seems to be the main way of doing it. Obviously, if you take chickens from one farm to another and they're sick, that would also be an issue. And so one of the possibilities that might happen is that they might stop what are called the chicken swaps, which are where people get together and sell each other chickens, usually from small backyard farms or people who raise them just because they look cool.
All right. Two last quick questions for you, Dave, if I could, please. You said already not harmful to people, right? So what advice are chicken farmers here in the Granite State getting to protect their flocks? I mean, we don't have these mega flocks like they do out in the Midwest, but there is a big backyard chicken community in New Hampshire.
There is a big backyard. There's about 1,300 backyard farms in the most recent USDA Census of Agriculture, a couple hundred thousand birds, 200,000, 220,000 laying birds. This is just egg birds now. And most of those farms are very small with fewer than 50 birds. So that, in a way, that makes it easier.
Right.
So it means that you can't come in and kill a whole bunch at once. But basically, it's keeping your flock clean and not having lots of muddy areas where the virus can live until another chicken picks it up.
All right. Dave Brooks, Telegraph of Nashua. Thank you so much.
You bet.
All right. Dean, I did want to ask you about a study that came out this week that I did want to get covered on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup and maybe do some more follow-up. This is the Pew Research Center's study of religious preferences in America and the 50 states. So it's interesting. They don't just look at the whole country. They look state by state. Pew surveyed Americans about their religious practices from 2007 to 2014. So this is new. What do the numbers show us, Dean?
Yeah, they do these studies periodically to kind of track trends in religiosity in the country. And, for New Hampshire, I mentioned earlier, and we've talked many times before about how New Hampshire is the second least religious state in the U.S. behind Vermont, and the current numbers are 36% of New Hampshire adults describe themselves as non-religious.
36.
Vermont's 37%. So we're actually neck and neck with Vermont. That far outweighs the number of individuals in the state who identify as Catholic. 26% in the study in New Hampshire identified as Catholic. 13% of New Hampshire adults describe themselves as evangelicals, and we were talking about evangelicals in the Iowa caucus. The biggest issue seems to be with millennials. People in their 20s are less involved in and drawn towards organized religion. They may be finding spirituality or religiosity in other ways through the internet or other kinds of outlets than your sort of standard, go to church on Sunday. The biggest drops in the study in New Hampshire are among Catholics and Protestants and Protestant denominations. And overall, you mentioned this sort of 7-year interval. In 2007, 78% of individuals in the U.S. Described themselves as Christian. That's dropped down to 71%.
That's a big drop.
It is a big drop. It's getting a lot of if you read the headlines around the web and in papers, this is sort of being viewed as a very dramatic drop. We've seen here in New Hampshire a number of churches selling property, consolidating parishes, et cetera. It's been an ongoing problem for some time for these organized denominations.
Sure. There's a big Catholic church not far from where I live, and I remember walking by it on Easter morning.
Yep.
Empty.
Right.
Parking lot, church, everything. And that was pretty striking to see. Trent Spinner, what do you think?
I think the most striking thing is that for the first time, the number of people who are not religious actually outnumber the largest denomination, which is Catholicism in New Hampshire.
And 10%, yeah.
Yeah. A huge difference. And so we talked to the bishop about this.
I wonder how they view this, religious leaders. Go ahead.
Yeah. And you know what was interesting was that the study said that there were more Catholics in New Hampshire than the bishop, than the diocese says they think they have. So it was an interesting little fact there. But the bishop says, look, it's challenging with young people nowadays to get them to come together in one place once a week and be religious. And, you know, he says there's a more individualistic society that we're living in today and that they are really grappling with how to deal with that.
I did read a quote from another leader. I think he was Protestant, Dean Spiliotis. He said, look, you know, and this is like sort of glass half full kind of guy. He said, this is great. There's no competition with other churches. We're all out for these unaffiliated folks. So he was putting a more positive spin on it.
Yeah, although, you know, we've seen these trends both here in the United States, organized religion in Europe as well has trended down dramatically in recent decades. It just, as Trent was noting, it just seems to be a kind of a fundamental change in how people find religion or express their spirituality as the population in the country becomes increasingly diverse as well.
All right. Well, Trent, I did want to ask you about a Manchester story that is somewhat related to this broader conversation we're having as a nation about police and their role. Manchester's police chief, David Mera, is retiring. What's Mera known for in Manchester? What are some of the big issues he worked on?
Chief Mera has really worked on bringing women onto the force, bringing minorities onto the force. He's tried to make the police department look more like the city of Manchester. And people who follow the police department say that he's been successful at doing that. Look, he does not have as many police officers as many other towns are, you know, Manchester size. So he is sort of fighting with some days he's fighting with one hand tied behind his back. And he has been successful at curbing crime and targeting certain communities where there have been problems. It's great, the Manchester Police Department now, you can go online and you can see on your block or in your neighborhood, you can see where the crimes happen, when they happen. And that was the chief who brought all of that in. So he's been on the force for 30 years. 30 years. He's been the chief for 7. He was kind of a surprise pick. He was a captain. And, you know, usually you'll see like a national search or at least a statewide search for somebody who's an assistant chief or a deputy chief somewhere. But he was a captain. The mayor and alderman went with him. It was kind of a surprise at the time. But, you know, he's been very successful.
How well has he straddled this line that police everywhere, Trent, find themselves straddling? You know, the public wants them to go after the bad guys, but they don't want them to go after in a way that, you know, ends up someone gets hurt or they go too far. And then we have these terrible cases like we've seen elsewhere.
Yeah. And the chief has had to deal with that. You know, there are people who want to open carry downtown, which is 100% legal. And the chief knows he's had to deal with this. He knows that his officers are going to be taped and that they have to follow the law. And I think he's done a lot of training inside the police department to make sure that people understand. The other issue I think he's dealt with is this terrible prank called swatting, where people call 911 and say that there's a guy with a gun inside of a house and he's been and we've seen a couple of those in the city. And I think that the chief has – these are incredibly dangerous. We just talked to a guy who was playing video games inside of his house and somebody called 911 and said that there was an armed intruder inside the house. And so it was dark. He had his headphones on, so he had no idea what was going on. And then the SWAT team was outside of his house. And you know what? The chief, I think, has set this tone where the police department is not going to just go in there guns blazing. And that's how I think this situation ended up with everyone walking away alive.
Whoa, I hadn't heard about that, Trent. So somebody makes a prank call and says, I have an armed intruder, and the police department sends in the SWAT team to protect this person, and it turns out to be a prank.
Right.
And some of these have actually been caught on video where, you know, somebody is playing video games and literally like the camera on the computer captures the SWAT team busting in and, you know, someone's going to get killed accidentally eventually just because of the, you know, intensity. But yeah, it's like a prank. You pull it on somebody else who's unaware that you've just called in a SWAT team on their house.
Okay, but what if there's a really bad crime on the other end of town and all the police are engaged at your house because of a stupid prank?
It's a terrible prank.
Wow. Okay. I had not heard about that. I did want to just very quickly follow up on a story that we've been covering here on The Exchange. After much, much, much public debate, the New Hampshire Fish and Game Commission decided to completely ban the use of chocolate for a hunting practice known as bear baiting. So just to put a final point on that, because we've talked about that a lot on The Roundup and on The Exchange. Next week on The Exchange, as part of NHPR's series called The First Decade, we're going to look at a number of topics, including child nutrition, early education, and how the so-called opportunity gap is showing up as a political and presidential campaign issue. That's what The Exchange is up to next week. And in fact, all of NHPR will be looking at this. How about you, Trent Spinner? What are you going to be looking at next week? Sounds like you got your hands full.
We've got
a Frank Into story.
Yes, you're going to want to read the New Hampshire Sunday News this week. Everyone who likes New Hampshire politics is going to want to read the New Hampshire Sunday News.
All right. So the Frank Inta story.
Frank Inta story is going to be huge for us.
Yeah.
Other stories. We are looking at the primary. You know, we offered Martin O'Malley an opportunity to come sit down with us. So we think that'll be interesting.
Maryland governor.
Yep.
And former governor.
Former governor. And I'm not sure when that's going to happen, but hopefully soon. So that'll be fun.
And he says he's going to make a decision about whether he's going to run for president at the end of
this month. Yes.
And then we talked earlier about James Webb, the other possible Democratic contender. Dean, what are you going to be looking at next
week? Well, it's just about crunch time for Senate budget writers. We're seeing new developments daily, like with the Renewable Energy Fund. So be watching the Senate, running out of time there by the end of June. And then also seeing the Frank Inta story develop, and then the presidential candidates. I'm very interested to see how Jim Webb's initial visit goes. This is a former Virginia senator, was a Republican, Secretary of the Navy, became a Democrat, and is viewed as kind of a more conservative alternative to, say, Bernie Sanders or even Hillary Clinton.
All right. So we could have a primary in the Democratic
side. We could.
Okay.
We'll
both of you, thank you very much. Trent Spinner, good to see you.
Thank you.
That's Trent Spinner, executive editor, the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Sunday News. Dean Spiliotis, thanks as always.
Sure thing.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy.